and I look forward to hearing from your people about those contributions. Taj nodded. Perhaps we can find time to speak privately when you return with Secretary Wicca's delegation. I think that can be arranged. Taj walked Ferris to his office door, standing by respectfully as the politician barked at his handlers and headed for the exit. Only when he'd disappeared down the hallway did Taj return to his desk. It was impossible to believe that the culmination of years of planning was only a week away. The assassination of President Chutani at his banquet for the Americans would be a trivial matter. Shaping the aftermath, though, would be more delicate. The people of Pakistan and the Middle East would have to be made to believe that the United States was responsible. The story was admittedly clumsy. Why would the Americans kill such a steadfast ally? Like in U.S. politics, though, truth was unimportant. People believed what they wanted to believe, and the hatred of America was incredibly powerful in his country. Following the president's death, Taj would waste no time. Using Shirani's army and his own influence with the Taliban, he would take control. Pakistan, now a failing patchwork of competing factions, would become a monolith, and the world would tremble. Chapter 27. Near Lake Constance, Switzerland.
I can't believe it was so easy, Gould said, his gun still trained on Rapp's head. Either you're slipping or your reputation came right out of the CIA's marketing department.
Rapp remained completely still, eyes locked on the Glock 17. Tom Lewis's psychological profile of Gould portrayed him as a narcissistic sociopath. Once again, the shrink's insights proved correct. The Frenchman had already managed to completely suppress the past, unable to admit that he could ever have been bested. Now he was busy building himself up into the legend he believed he deserved to be. It was a weakness that could be exploited, but even with that possibility, Rapp recognized that this was about as deadly a situation as he'd ever faced. Nutcase or no, Gould wasn't going to miss at this or any other range. The murk in Rapp's peripheral vision had a crimson puddle growing around his left foot, but the blood loss and pain weren't preventing him from holding the MP5 rock steady. Finally, the man who'd shoved Hurley through the door was undoubtedly still standing right on the other side of it. The old man looked like his head had cleared, but that didn't do anything about the fact that he was well past his sell-by date. Unlike Rapp, though, physical talent and the ability to instantly analyze tactical situations weren't what had made Stan Hurley one of the most effective killers of his generation. He operated entirely on rage, and based on the expression on his face, the decades hadn't dimmed it.
"What are you waiting for?" Gould taunted. "You think Scott's going to rescue you? That knoll's completely surrounded by Obrecht's men. If Coleman's not dead already, he will be soon."
"Mitch, Stan, if you can hear this, get ready. Things are about to get a lot less subtle." Hurley's fake hearing aid had been taken, making it impossible for him to hear Coleman's warning.
"Scott might just surprise you," Rapp said to get the old man's attention.
He made a subtle motion toward Gould with his thumb. Hurley had the better angle on the Frenchman. That left Rapp tangling with a badly injured, no-name merc, while an octogenarian with a freshly replaced hip took on one of the best contractors in the world. The thermobaric charge worked as advertised, creating an eardrum-splitting explosion and shaking the mansion violently enough to cause Gould's pistol to dip. Rapp dove toward the mercenary, hoping to draw both men's fire. Surprise and blood loss delayed the merc's reaction, but not Gould's. His shot struck Rapp's flak jacket just above his navel, flipping him onto his side, next to the Glock still lying on the carpet. Behind, Rapp could hear the muffled sound of Gould's weapon firing repeatedly. He couldn't worry about that, though. It was Hurley's problem. The MP5 opened up, stitching holes in the floor as it arced toward him. The statue was still blocking his line of sight to the man's head, so Rapp snatched up his Glock and pumped around into the man's other foot. This time he went down, losing control of his weapon and cutting through the plaster ceiling. Still lying on his side, Rapp lined up on the underside of the fallen merc's chin and blew the top of his head off.
Rapp immediately rolled onto his back and aimed at the door. Predictably, it was thrown open by the man who had captured Hurley. Rapp squeezed the trigger and put a round through the man's mouth, sending brain tissue, teeth, and shards of skull spraying out into the hallway. It was only then that he could turn his attention to Hurley and Gould. They were pressed together face to face. Gould's gun was shoved into Hurley's stomach, and he was emptying it into the man. The back of Hurley's shirt was torn and wet with blood from numerous exit wounds. His face was buried in the side of Gould's neck, but Rapp didn't understand why until his old friend finally collapsed to the floor. Gould slapped a hand to the side of his throat, but it did no good. Bright red arterial blood was flowing through his fingers and from his mouth. He swung his gun toward Rapp and pulled the trigger, unable to process the fact that it was empty. When the Frenchman finally realized that the weapon was useless, he lurched right, stumbling toward the door. He bounced off the jamb and was gone. The sound of automatic gunfire was starting outside as Rapp crawled to where Hurley was lying on the blood-soaked carpet. His friend stared up at him, and for one of the few times in his life, Rapp's emotions made it difficult to speak. "What happened to the belt-buckle knife you've been bragging about for the last 20 years? Hurley laughed, ejecting a sizable chunk of Gould's neck from his mouth.
"Got stuck. Can you believe it? I'm gonna get that old bitch who made it for me."
Rapp stared down at the man, feeling a constriction in his chest that he told himself was the result of Gould's bullet. "I'm sorry, Stan. This was my op, my failure." Hurley managed to press a bloody hand against Rapp's shoulder. It might have been the first overt display of affection in their long relationship.
"No, it was perfect."
And then Stan Hurley, a man who had survived everything, from the Soviets to the rise of Muslim extremism, died. Rapp stood and slipped through the door with his Glock held out in front of him. The scent of chemical explosive was mixing with the gunpowder haze hanging in the air, creating an environment that he'd become all too familiar with. Outside, it sounded like Obrecht's men had regrouped and were hitting Coleman's force hard. The former SEAL would just have to hang on. The trail wasn't particularly subtle, and Rapp followed it down the hallway until it turned into a bedroom on the right. He found Gould sitting on the floor, propped up beneath a window. The Frenchman clawed for the empty gun next to him, but didn't have the strength to pick it up. His other hand was still clamped weakly to his neck, but the entire left side of his body was drenched in blood. Rapp took aim, thinking of Anna and his unborn child, as the assassin struggled to focus. A moment later, he lowered his pistol and went for the door. Even after everything Gould had done to him, this was the old man's kill. Chapter 28. Scott Coleman was in a prone position at the bottom of a shallow impression in the dirt. The bushes were dense enough to make him invisible from the mansion, but he'd cut away a few to give him a view of the chaos he'd created. The smoke had dissipated to the point that he could see the massive hole in the wall surrounding Obrecht's property, but not enough of the cameras on Marcus Dumont's drone to provide a reliable overhead feed. Flames were licking the blackened edges of the breach, and burning cinder blocks dotted the ground almost to the tree line. He swept his scope along the newly created gap, noting two men down. The one lying face down was still intact, but in a grotesque position that suggested there wasn't an unbroken bone in his body. The other was on fire.
"Targets?"
he said over his mic. Wicker and McGraw both returned negatives. Based on the radio chatter, Rapp was alive and on the move. Hurley and Gould's conditions were more ambiguous. He activated his throat mic again. Rapp knew he was constantly broadcasting, but it was still unusual for him not to have made a specific report of his status.
"Mitch, give me a sit rep."
There was a delay long enough to make Coleman start to worry, but then Rapp's voice came on.
"Gould, Stan, and two tangos down in the mansion. This frequency's been compromised. Cut me out."
Coleman let out a quiet breath and did as ordered, mentally assessing the situation. Hurley and Gould were dead. Rapp was running around the building with no way for Coleman to track his position or status. They'd just detonated a projectile that was loud enough to wake people in Madagascar. And by his count,
there were still 8 serious shooters digging into what he assumed were hardened positions. His earpiece produced a series of beeps in the eerie post-explosion silence, notifying him of an incoming encrypted call on his cell phone.
"Done," Maria Glauser said, and then disconnected.
As their logistical support person, she'd carried out their contingency plan for covering up the rocket attack. Rapp had come up with the idea of filling a vacant house in a nearby subdivision with plastique. She'd blown it the moment she heard the blast created by the Samoa, and now her people were calling in breathless reports of a gas explosion. It wasn't a permanent solution by a long shot, but it would buy them a little time with the local authorities.
"Movement on the fence line," McGraw said over the radio. "Are you both seeing this?"
Coleman eased his rifle left, finally finding a disturbance in the smoke at the top of an undamaged section of wall. It was too big to be a man, and rising with the smooth steadiness of some kind of mechanical platform.
"Take cover!"
Coleman shouted, though he knew his men in the trees had a limited ability to do so. He flattened himself in the shallow ditch, just as the familiar buzz of a Gatling gun started up. He could hear the shattering of wood and the crash of falling branches as rounds spewed from the weapon at a rate of 3,000 per minute. When the bullet stream passed overhead, Coleman was forced to roll into a ball to protect himself from the debris raining down on him. Then everything went silent again. The gunner had no visible targets. He was just sending a message, a very clear one.
"Sound off," he said into his radio.
"No injuries," McGraw said. The unflappable Charlie Wicker came on right after.
"I want to talk about my compensation package."
Coleman ignored him.
"Bruno, do you have a line on that guy?"
"Negative. He's completely shielded. At best, he's using cameras for targeting. At worst, the gun's remote controlled."
"Wick?" "I'm still lined up on the knoll. Can't even see the gun placement."
"Any movement?"
"The explosion seems to have lit a fire under them. Looks like they're retreating and that they're going to just leave their wounded man." "Joe, did you copy that? Those guys are coming in your direction."
Maslick, who was still covering the tunnel exit, responded immediately.
"I copied."
"Do not engage," Coleman said. "I repeat, do not engage. I don't want to do anything to give away your position or change their mind about running. Just stay sharp and watch for Obrecht."
"Roger that."
Coleman crawled forward through the downed leaves and branches. The Gatling gun was fully visible now, moving smoothly back and forth on what he guessed were electric motors. It seemed likely that there was a similar weapon on the southern end of the wall, but the damage there was significant enough that he doubted it was something he'd have to deal with. They must have been mounted beneath the wooden promenade behind the fence, keeping them hidden from Dumont's drones.
"Let me know if you acquire a target. But no one shoots without my express order. We can't afford to draw that kind of fire."
He swept his scope over the scene again. The smoke continued to thin, and now he could see a single open window in one of the attic dormers. No doubt there was a sniper just inside, and even less doubt that he was top-notch.
"Bruno, you see that window?"
"Yeah, but I got nothing."
It had gone quiet enough that Coleman could hear his own breathing and the light breeze rattling the leaves. It was a sound he was depressingly familiar with, the sound of an operation dead in the water. Back in the day, this was about the time he'd be calling in air support. Paint the compound with a laser and let the flyboys drop something nasty from the stratosphere. There were times he really missed the Navy. Coleman finally made a decision and enabled Rapp's radio frequency again.
"There's a Gatling gun placement on the north side of the wall," he said. "Remember Herat?"
If Overek's men were monitoring their communications, they would have no idea what he was talking about. Herat was a city in Afghanistan where he and Rapp had been pinned down for more than an hour by a sniper in the upper floor of a hotel. As expected, there was no response, but hopefully the message got through. Rapp was in a position to flank Obrecht's men, and if he could just take a little of the heat off, Coleman's team could advance. If not, they would be forced to leave him. Kennedy's orders were clear. At the first hint of Swiss authorities, they were to get the hell out of Dodge.
"Come down and regroup around me," he said, after killing the connection to Rapp again. "One way or another, we're going to have to move fast."
Chapter 29. Near Georgetown, Washington, D.C., USA.
Irene Kennedy adjusted the lamp for the third time. Finally, she was forced to admit that her inability to read the classified documents lying on her desk had nothing to do with a lack of illumination. Her normally unshakable ability to concentrate had simply failed her. She took off her glasses and looked around the windowless office tucked away at the back of her home. Not that there was much to see. She'd left the overhead lights off, as was her custom. The semi-darkness was usually accompanied by a sense of security. Not that day, though. If anything, it magnified the anxiety and regret building in her. Joe Rickman's files were still out there, and it was her failure. She should have seen it coming. Rickman had always been unstable, but he'd also been brilliant. He could do things that no one else could, and she had become reliant on, perhaps even blinded by, his talents. There were no easy problems for the person running the Central Intelligence Agency. Those were dealt with well before they reached her office. Her world was an endless knife-edge balancing act. There were no wins, only scenarios where the rewards slightly outweighed the risks. In the current situation, her careful evaluation of the circumstances had led her to the wrong strategy. Or, as Mitch would undoubtedly simplify it, she'd guessed wrong. The secure phone next to her began to ring, and she reached for it reluctantly. Another drawback to her job was that people rarely called her at home with good news.
"Yes." "They've blown the fence," Marcus Dumont said. "The smoke's blinding my drone."
"Thank you." She hung up and felt the knot in her stomach tighten. The Obrecht operation had been authorized entirely on her own authority. Neither the Swiss government nor President Alexander knew anything about it. There hadn't been time for debate, and no wasn't an option. It would be easier to offer her resignation than ask permission. Kennedy reached for the phone again, but then withdrew her hand. She had a direct line to Scott Coleman, but it existed only for emergencies. She laid out the rules of engagement for this rendition, and Coleman would follow her orders to the letter. Rapp and Hurley, on the other hand, would do whatever they wanted. There was no action she could take and no update that would matter at this point. The die had been cast. Instead of the phone, she used her laptop to check her email account. Automatic notifications had been set up in case she received another communication from Rickman, so she knew she wouldn't find anything. Still, it offered some small comfort to see the empty inbox. It was just a matter of time, though. Rickman wouldn't let something as trivial as death stop him. He was far too smart and obsessive for that. No, if he'd embarked on a plan this grand, he would have made it foolproof. Unstoppable. Would she be the director who presided over the disintegration of America's intelligence capability? Was she responsible for recruiting and training the man who would tear down her country's defenses just when the world was at its most dangerous and unpredictable? Afghanistan was in the process of returning to what Americans considered medieval chaos, but the Afghans thought of as normalcy. Various terrorist groups would use the lawlessness and lack of cohesion as cover. But the Afghans themselves posed less of a threat than most people suspected. They didn't much like outsiders, and with a little prompting could be used to combat the terrorist groups wanting to use their country as a base. Iraq was a far more dangerous situation, and one of the keys to the current instability in the Middle East. The truth was that little could be done to remedy the situation militarily, and arming moderates in the region was a strategy almost certain to backfire. People who felt moderately about things tended not to fight with the same intensity as fanatics. More often than not, they handed over their American-provided weapons and ran. Or worse, they reacted to the brutality they saw by becoming fanatics in their own right. Sadly, the best answer was for her to insert a brutal pro-American dictator. With a little luck, that would create an environment in which the rest of the region could be stabilized. Less visceral, but perhaps more dangerous, were the former and future world powers. Russia was trying to restart the Cold War in order to gain the respect it craved, but was incapable of earning with its anemic economy and corrupt institutions. China was trying to take possession of every piece of territory it had ever laid claim to in a cynical effort to distract its people from slowing GDP growth and an environmental disaster that was beginning to bite.
And then there was Pakistan. As it stood, the ISI was so compartmentalized that one division could be tracking down a particular terrorist cell while another division supported it. Infighting was the norm, with people actively hamstringing operations in order to discredit their rivals and advance their own careers. The director tended to set broad goals, but the real power lay with the deputies who protected their fiefdoms like a pack of wild dogs. This, among other things, had made the ISI's anti-terrorist efforts sporadic and often counterproductive. Problematic? Yes. Destructive to the region? Absolutely. A clear and present danger to the United States? Likely not. The problem was that the ISI she had set up the CIA to handle was transforming at a pace she would have never thought possible. Nadeem Ashan, the eminently reasonable deputy general for analysis and foreign relations, was under house arrest. Akhtar Durrani, the violent but dull-witted head of the external wing, was dead. And Ahmed Taj had replaced both with men her analysts were unfamiliar with. The S-wing was evolving, too. At first, the CIA had seen the shrinking of the ISI's clandestine division as a good sign. Now, though, it was clear that it was just shedding its weaker agents and stepping farther into the shadows. She pulled up a photo of Ahmed Taj on her laptop, studying his dull, downturned eyes for a long time. He'd been chosen by Saad Chutani for his competence in logistics, moderate views, and lack of ambition. Beyond that, the CIA had uncovered little about the man. He'd grown up in a poor area of the country where written records were sparse and life expectancy was low enough that human intel about his childhood was little more than third-hand innuendo. His father had been a pious and talented businessman who had provided Taj a life somewhat more privileged than those around him, as well as a university education in America. What hard data they possessed pointed to mediocrity in all areas of Taj's life. His grades, his extracurricular activities, his military record. Ironically, it was this that had worried the CIA's Pakistan experts most. Many had predicted the ISI fracturing even further with such a weak hand at the helm. And yet, the opposite seemed to be true. Under the command of Taj and the ostensibly weak men he had recruited, the ISI seemed to be gaining the discipline it had always lacked. She glanced at the report she'd been reading and closed the folder. It was yet another analysis of Taj's ISI. More pages of the bizarre intellectual contortions necessary to explain Pakistan's increasingly stable intelligence apparatus. The popular theory now was that it was being held together by the middle managers whom, a few years earlier, the same analysts were blaming for the organization's Wild West culture. Everything the CIA knew about the modern ISI had been learned by viewing the organization through the lens of Taj's weakness. And every prediction that lens produced had proved wrong. What if their most basic assumptions about the man were inaccurate? What if they were seeing only what he wanted them to see? She picked up the phone and dialed a number for the third time that day. Senator Ferris's office? Is he in? This is Irene Kennedy. I'm sorry, Director Kennedy, he's not available. I've given him your messages, but he just returned from Pakistan, and his schedule's full. Do you want me to tell him you called again? No, it's not important, she said, disconnecting the call. Her sources said that Ferris and Taj had met privately during his fact-finding mission in Islamabad. She was very interested in what the two men discussed. In the end, though, the influential senator's refusal to return her calls was more instructive than any of the half-truths he'd tell about his meeting. She had always known that her threats against him were only a temporary fix. Like many of his colleagues, Ferris would gladly destroy the CIA, the country, and perhaps even himself before he would allow anyone to get in the way of his ambition. He had already hired a battery of Ivy League lawyers with PAC money that was impossible for even her to trace. Now, he was in talks with some of the country's top political operatives. There could be little doubt that he was looking to turn the tables on her and continue his march toward his party's presidential nomination. Normally, this would be of great concern, But in this case, Rapp was right. In the context of the Rickman affair, this bloated, ridiculous man seemed almost comical. What concerned her more than Ferris's growing army of attorneys and spin doctors was his relationship with Ahmed Taj. Once again, this outwardly inconsequential Pakistani had appeared at the center of a dire situation. A quiet knock wrenched her back into the present, and she deleted Taj's picture from her computer screen. "Come in." The door swung open, and she squinted at her 17-year-old son, backlit by the sun streaming through her house's windows. She'd completely forgotten it was a beautiful morning. "Why is it so dark in here, Mom?" "I have a bit of a headache." "Maybe that's because you sit around in this closet all the time," he said, playing the exasperated teen to hide his concern. "It's awesome on the back deck." "You make a good point. Maybe I'll try that." Tommy didn't respond, but also didn't move from the doorframe. He obviously had something to say, and Kennedy stared silently at him for a few seconds before admonishing herself. It was a tactic she used to draw information out of her opponents. This was her child. "What's on your mind, son?" He looked at his shoes. "Is Mitch going to be at the game tomorrow?" After their divorce, Tommy's father had moved away and completely lost interest in his boy. Rapp had done a lot to fill that void over the years, taking Tommy to ball games, remembering every birthday, and teaching him the fine art of lacrosse. "I don't know. He's out of town." "Where?" "Surfing, I think." Tommy laughed and answered her obvious lie with a quote from Apocalypse Now. "Charlie don't surf." He was an extraordinarily intelligent and insightful boy. Straight A's with no effort, nearly a perfect score on his SATs, and every college from Harvard to MIT actively recruiting him. He was also extremely inquisitive, which wasn't always a good thing. He'd made it his business to become an encyclopedia of the CIA, with a particular interest in every bad decision, screw-up, and unintended consequence in its long history. As forms of rebellion went, she supposed it was better than alcohol or drugs. "So you think he might miss it?" Tommy said, sounding a little hopeful. "That he might not be back in time?" "You seem relieved." Another brief examination of his shoes. "The guy's like a lacrosse genius. Some people still think he's the best player ever. Did you know he can remember where everyone on the field was at any point in a game? It's like you guys installed a computer chip in his brain." He paused. "You didn't, did you?" "Not that I'm aware of." "So he's basically Wayne Gretzky, and I'm just okay." His assessment was entirely accurate. In fact, the only reason he was even okay was that Rapp had been working with him since he was 6. Kennedy admired people who could realistically assess their weaknesses and normally would wonder aloud about the best way for them to minimize the effect of those weaknesses. This wasn't one of her operatives, though. "You're too hard on yourself, Tommy. Mitch says you're doing really well." "Give me a break, Mom. He thinks I'm slow, inaccurate, and too passive." "What makes you think that?" "Because he told me I'm slow, inaccurate, and too passive." She made a mental note to talk to Rapp about that. "He just wants you to be the best you can be." "I know, Mom, but it's a little..." His voice trailed off, and she smiled sympathetically. What could the kid do? He'd inherited his parents' 4 left feet. "Is it fun?" "Sure, the guys are great, and we have cheerleaders now." "Then go out there and have a good time, Tommy. Don't worry about impressing Mitch. Worry about impressing those cheerleaders."
Chapter 30. Near Lake Constance, Switzerland. Rapp swung his Glock right, checking motion at the end of the hallway. He lined his sights up on the head of the maid he'd seen earlier and watched her disappear back through the doorway with a strangled scream. He continued moving along the hazy corridor, clearing rooms as he went. According to Coleman, at least one tango was in the attic with a sniper rifle. Another would be operating the Gatling gun, but there was no way to know if he was doing it directly or remotely. Rapp guessed the latter. When he'd started in this business, setting something like that up would have cost millions of dollars and required an army of engineers. Now it could be done by a couple of teenagers with an iPhone. As he passed, Rapp closed the door to the room the maid was hiding in. Judging from her expression, she could be trusted to stay put until this was over. Hopefully, Obrecht's other civilian employees were similarly holed up. Near the end of the hallway, he paused again. The question was whether to take the wide-open stairs that dominated the front of the building, or the less prominent servants' access he and Gould had come up. Neither option was good, but he calculated his odds as slightly better on the main staircase. The other offered no room to maneuver, and his gut said it was being covered. On this rare occasion, his gut was wrong. He eased down the steps, staying low behind the railing and searching for targets. Nothing. In the ground-floor entryway, he slipped by an elaborate flower arrangement and passed the entrance to the service stairs unchallenged. With their limited remaining manpower, the Mercs appeared to have retreated to prearranged defensive positions, probably concentrated on the front and rear entrances. Outside, there was still silence. Coleman was stuck, and Obrecht's men were satisfied to turn this into a stalemate. Time was on their side. The local authorities were likely already on their way. Rapp slid with his back against the wall until he came to the closed door leading to the basement. Obrecht would either be down there trying to figure out why he couldn't get his safe room door open, or he'd be in the tunnel heading for Joe Maslick's position. Either way, that little Swiss prick was going to spill everything he knew before Rapp put him in the ground. He reached out and twisted the knob, throwing the door open. The sharp hiss of a silenced weapon followed immediately, and two holes appeared in the wall across from him. Obrecht? Probably not. Based on the speed of the trigger finger and the tight grouping, one of his security team. The light in the basement was on, and Rapp slapped a hand around the jamb, sliding it down the wall and catching the switch. A round hit close enough to send splinters of wood into his unprotected forearm. He ignored the superficial wound and retreated behind a heavy sideboard, using his shoulder to shove it toward the open door. More shots sounded as he squeezed it through the opening, but they couldn't penetrate the thick mahogany. He followed it inside, pushing it along the landing until it tipped partially down the stairs. Movement became audible below as the shooter tried to find an angle. Rapp grabbed one of the night-vision-enabled helmets he'd hidden by the stairs and slammed the door behind him. The darkness closed in, and he heard the man below freeze, suddenly unable to navigate the cluttered space. After toggling the goggles' power switch, Rapp gave the sideboard one last shove. The heavy piece of furniture careened down the stairs with Rapp following inches behind. The puff of silenced shots joined the crackle of splintering wood as the man below attempted to aim by ear. It was effective enough that halfway down, Rapp ducked under the railing and took the short drop, landing next to a stack of decaying pallets. The sideboard hit the floor a moment later, barely holding together as it came to a stop. Rapp moved right, holding his breath and watching his foot placements to remain completely silent. Everything was bathed in a computer-generated false light, and he immediately picked out two separate targets in the bright orange that denoted body heat. The one near the safe room was slumped against the closed door in a seated position. The other was lying in the dirt, holding something that Rapp's goggles painted half blue and half red. The cool metal of a gun tipped with a hot silencer. Every man had his breaking point, and the prone Merc finally reached his. Trails of color streaked from the hazy image as he switched to full automatic and started spraying bullets randomly around the basement. Rapp ignored the rounds flying past him and ricocheting off the stone walls. He squeezed off a single shot, and a moment later the only sound in the basement was emanating from a nicked water pipe. He approached the mercenary carefully, despite the fact that he was picking up specks of body heat orange spread out around what a moment ago had been the man's head. Satisfied that he was dead, Rapp moved silently toward the tango near the safe room. It was slow going, but he managed to come within 3 feet without making any sound at all. Once in position, he reached out and touched his silencer to the side of the man's head. Nothing. Rapp retracted the night vision gear and fished a small penlight from his pocket. He switched it on and found exactly what he feared. Leo Obrecht, with his throat slit, ear to ear. Whatever had been locked up in his head was going to stay there. Rapp used the penlight to find the tunnel entrance and punched the code Gould had given him into the keypad. The chances of it working were close to zero, but it was worth a try. He still needed to retrieve Hurley's body, and if he could slip it out this way, there was a good chance his entire team could be on a jet back to the States before sundown. The surviving mercs would tell their story, and at the end of a multi-year investigation, the Swiss authorities would chalk this up to Obrecht getting in over his head with a professional assassin. Of course, Gould's code didn't work, so that left the hard way. Rapp skirted the sideboard at the bottom of the steps and ascended to the door again. There was no sound on the other side, so he eased it open. A quick check in both directions suggested that Obrecht's guards either were ignorant of what had just happened to their comrade or didn't care enough to come to his aid. Probably the latter. The servant stairs still appeared to be unguarded, so Rapp ran for them, ascending the tightly winding steps three at a time. He continued until they dead-ended into a bare wood door leading into the attic. The way it was aligned meant that it should open directly onto the west-facing dormers where the riflemen worrying Coleman would be set up. Snipers tended to work in teams, so Rapp assumed two men. Based on their vantage point, it would make sense for the spotter to be at the dormer to the right. That would also put him in a reasonable position to cover the door. Based on the architectural plans he'd studied, Rapp put the spotter at 2 o'clock, with the sniper dead at 12. What would be between him and the two mercs was impossible to know for certain. Even if the attic was as cluttered as the basement, though, he guessed he'd have a shot. They would have moved anything obstructing their line of retreat. Rapp took a few steps back and charged the door, throwing a foot out into the ancient wood. As expected, it gave easily, and he went sailing through, gun stretched out in front of him. The spotter was right where he expected him to be. Also, as anticipated, he'd been paying close attention to the door. Rapp saw a muzzle flash and felt the sting of a bullet grazing his right shoulder. He lined up his sights and fired, twisting in the air without bothering to confirm if he'd hit his target. When he landed on the wood floor, he was facing the sniper, who was spinning in his direction. The rifle was far too unwieldy for him to move quickly, though, and Rapp's shot hit him directly between the eyes. Rapp got to his feet and moved to the edge of the window, careful not to expose himself to Bruno McGraw, who would be watching for movement. He activated his throat mic, mindful that the frequency had been compromised. Ended like Herat, too. Coleman would understand. Rapp had resolved their sniper problem in that Afghan town by scaling the wall and shooting the man through a broken window.
Roger that.
Rapp was now able to move to a better vantage point without worrying about being taken out by McGraw. He could see the damage to the wall was as impressive as the guy from Raytheon had promised, a burning hole that you could drive a semi through. Other than the two dead men on the ground, none of Obrecht's mercs were in evidence. The Gatling gun was bolted to a platform on the north end of the wall. There was no operator visible, but various cables and flexible hoses were. Definitely remote-controlled. But from where? Rapp started for the exit, but then spotted an iPad lying on the floor next to the dead spotter. He was going to stuff it in the waistband of his fatigues for Dumont to examine, but stopped when the screen came to life. It displayed 4 squares, arranged vertically on the left. 3 were blank, and 1 was feeding video of the tree line west of the wall. Alongside each square were arrows for up, down, right, and left, as well as a green and red button. He pressed the right arrow next to the live image, and it tracked obediently north. Rapp moved to a position where he could see the Gatling gun placement and tapped the arrow again. If the only man who could help them figure out Joe Rickman's plan weren't lying dead in the basement, he might have actually smiled. The gun obeyed his command. Now the only question was how cautious the engineers who had set up the weapon were. Rapp would have had its range of motion limited, but most people were less suspicious of technology than he was. It turned out Obrecht's men fit into the latter category. By pressing and holding the right arrow, Rapp was able to spin the gun 360 degrees. He ran a finger down the green buttons on the iPad and watched 2 of the 3 other camera feeds come to life. They were gray at first, scanning the interior surface of the wall as the guns rose on hydraulic lifts. In a few seconds, both had cleared the barrier and were showing high-definition images of the surrounding forest. Using the arrows, he spun the guns to aim at the ground floor of the building, concentrating on the points of entry.
Get ready to move, he said into his throat mic.
Coleman sounded a bit confused at what he saw as Rapp knowingly giving away their strategy.
This frequency's being monitored. I repeat, this frequency's being monitored.
In a second is not going to matter, Rapp said, swiping the red buttons pulsing on the screen.
South corner clear, one tango down,
Wicker's voice said over the radio.
West corner clear, Bruno McGraw followed up. One man dead, all civilian employees, uninjured and accounted for.
Rapp could feel the blood flowing down the back of his flak jacket as he fireman carried Stan Hurley's body down the stairs. The dust on the ground floor was thick enough to make it hard to breathe. There was a hole about 9 feet in diameter next to the door, and a significant portion of the wall to the right of it had collapsed. Scott Coleman was putting flex cuffs on a man lying face down in a bed of shattered glass. At the other end of the room, the upper half of a torso was on its side in the fireplace. A quick scan of the demolished room didn't turn up the rest of the body.
One more over there,
Coleman said, shaken by the sight of Hurley's body but trying to hide it.
That leaves one unaccounted for, Rapp responded.
Charlie Wicker came on the comm a moment later.
There's a man running east toward the wall. I have a shot.
Rapp gave a subtle nod, and Coleman brought a bleeding hand to his throat mic.
Take him.
Affirmative. Tango's down.
The man at Coleman's feet craned his neck around and looked up. Rapp didn't know him, but the recognition and fear were clear in his eyes.
You speak English? Rapp said.
Yes.
Louis Gould brought in a team to take out Obrecht, Rapp said to him. Your men killed Gould, but not before he got to Obrecht. The rest of his team got away to the east. You're the only survivor.
I understand.
Do you?
Because if I find out there was any confusion, I'll come looking for you.
There's no confusion.
A siren became audible in the distance, and Rapp started for the hole next to the door.
Cut him loose and get your men out of here, Scott. Rendezvous at Location Bravo, and get hold of Maria. Tell her about the change in plan, and give her an ETA.
Coleman nodded, and Rapp jogged out into the sunlight. He had 5 miles of hard terrain to cover, with a marginal knee and 150 pounds of dead weight bleeding all over his shoulder. Somehow, he'd always known that Hurley would get the last laugh.
Chapter 31 Rome, Italy.
Isabella Accorso's nausea reached its peak when her daughter's school came into view through the windshield. She fought the urge to vomit, reminding herself that Bianca had promptly returned her text, as she always did. Still, for the entire drive, she'd been unable to fight back thoughts of police barricades, ambulances, and a single human form lying beneath a bloody white sheet. The swaying of the car as she turned into the parking area almost pushed her over the edge, but then she saw her daughter leaning safely against the building. She was clutching her backpack to her chest, an expression of concern etched into her normally smooth face. Isabella had given no explanation when she'd requested that Bianca be pulled from class. What explanation could there be?
Ma, she said as she opened the car door and slipped inside. What's going on?
Nothing.
Isabella pulled away a little too quickly, once again checking the rearview mirror.
Seriously, Mom, you're scaring me. Why are you here? Why aren't you at work?
Isabella felt a tear starting down her cheek and wiped it away, trying to hide the emotions overwhelming her. The man she'd met that day was deeply evil. She could feel it every time he turned his black eyes on her. There was nothing he wouldn't do to get what he wanted. He would have murdered her daughter and 1,000 like her without a second thought. There'd been no choice but to follow his instructions exactly.
Is Dad okay?
Of course he is, honey.
She didn't know that for certain, but saw no reason why he wouldn't be. They'd been divorced for 4 years now. Bianca's father wasn't a bad man, but he'd taken a job in Sweden, and their marriage hadn't been strong enough to handle the distance.
Is it because Dad's getting remarried?
Isabella smiled.
No, I'm happy for him and Agda. Are you all right with it?
Sure, it doesn't matter. I hardly ever see him.
He's your father, Bianca.
I know, and I love him. But he's up there, you know, and we're here.
It was one of the reasons Isabella had formed such a strong bond with her daughter. Bianca was everything to her. Probably too much. One day soon,
she'd be an adult and leave. She'd start her own life, her own family. For now, though, they were together, and she was safe.
"Is it something at work?" Bianca probed. "You didn't lose your job, did you? At the Christmas party, Mr. Cipriani said the firm couldn't run without you. I heard him."
She'd been prepared for the subject of work to come up, and didn't let the weak trickle of adrenaline show as she accelerated onto a two-lane highway.
"My job's fine. Stop worrying. Everything's fine."
"No, it's not." Isabella tried to smile, but it came off as more of a grimace. She'd done everything the man had asked, wiping all trace of the anonymous client from the mainframe. There was nothing she could do about the original copy of the instructions in the attorney's office, and the man appeared to understand that. He hadn't seemed angry. How could she be certain, though? Who was he? Why had these files been so important to him? He was well-dressed and looked Arab or Indian, but beyond that she knew nothing about him. Was he a drug trafficker? Did this have something to do with the heroin she knew was produced in the Middle East? If so, what business was it of hers? People wanted heroin. There was no stopping it.
"Where are we going, Ma? Home?"
She nodded. "So we can change. I thought we'd go out to dinner tonight. How does La Stiva sound?" It was Bianca's favorite restaurant, but money had been tight for the past few years, and they never went any more. The budget was hard on her. Young girls needed to fit in, and that had become an expensive enterprise. She never complained, though.
"It sounds great, I guess, but what's the occasion?"
Isabella almost started crying again, but managed to maintain control. The occasion was that her daughter hadn't been murdered.
"You're going to be a woman soon, and we might not have time to spend together then," she said, her voice sounding slightly strangled. "I thought it would be nice. We can talk."
Bianca didn't look like she believed any of what she was being told, but realized she wasn't going to get any more out of her mother on the drive. No doubt she was scheduling a full interrogation for after a bottle of wine had been opened. They continued in silence, and Isabella felt doubt creeping in. Was the Arab man really gone, or would he come back for something else? Was it possible that he wasn't a drug dealer? Could he be a terrorist? Was she putting people in danger by not going to the police? Ahead, she saw a semi-truck approaching in the oncoming lane. It started to swerve, almost rocking up on two wheels as its load of concrete pipes shifted. Isabella slammed on her brakes and threw an arm instinctively in front of her daughter as the truck crossed into the lane in front of them.
Chapter 32. Near Lake Constance, Switzerland. "We're clear," Wicker said, motioning the team forward and starting to run again. Mitrap released the tree he was using for balance and lurched forward, falling in behind Scott Coleman. His knee felt like it was full of glass, and most of his right side had gone numb. Despite that, and a number of offers of help, he'd carried Hurley's body the entire way by himself. He had been in command when his friend was killed. It was his responsibility to get him out. They finally stopped where the stream took a hard bend, creating a deep pool that shimmered almost black in the late afternoon sun. Joe Maslick dropped to his stomach next to it, reaching down into the water.
"Got them!"
He pulled out two large dry bags while the rest of the men peeled off their packs. Rapp nearly fell, trying to get Hurley off his shoulder, and dropped the man's body unceremoniously into a pile of rocks.
"Scott!"
Maslick said, throwing a duct-tape-wrapped package to Coleman. He reached back into the bag and retrieved another, almost identical package.
"This is you, Bruno."
Rapp stripped and dove into the water as Maslick pulled out the bundle meant for Stan. A body bag. The sudden cold and darkness was strangely comforting, and he stayed under for longer than he should have, reveling in the stillness. When he and Anna lived near the Chesapeake, he swam almost every day. It was one of the many little pleasures from his past that had fallen away. When he surfaced, his men were cutting open their packages. Business suits, uniforms, and jogging clothes appeared along with wallets full of carefully forged documents. All the things necessary to separate and disappear. Coleman tore the tape off the package meant for Rapp and tossed him a bar of abrasive soap. He caught it and use it to wash away the dried blood that covered most of his body. Wicker was the first dressed, and he collected everyone's discarded clothing, stuffing it into the dry bags. When he was finished, he headed for the road without a word. Decked out in running clothes, he would do another 10 miles on his shoulder before he got to the car waiting for him. It was a lightly traveled thoroughfare, and having all of them drive out at one time could raise suspicion. Staggering the time and method of escape was more critical than getting out fast. Rapp dunked under again, struggling to get his matted hair clean, as Bruno McGraw slipped away in a tailored business suit. When Rapp resurfaced, Coleman was wearing a FedEx uniform beneath an apron and elbow-length rubber gloves. The ease and speed with which he got Hurley into the body bag was a testament to how much practice they all had in such things. Rapp climbed onto the bank and toweled off, dressing in the jeans, collared shirt, and leather jacket laid out for him on a rock. It felt uncomfortable not to have a weapon, but his Glock was tucked away in the dry bags with the rest of the team's gear. In light of the recent fireworks, running into a roadblock was fairly likely, and carrying a gun was too much of a risk. "We're ready," Coleman said. Everything, including Hurley, had been consolidated into backpacks or bags and was piled up at the west end of the clearing. Rapp glanced at his watch and picked up two of the packs. 6 minutes. They needed to ferry all of it to the edge of the road, where a van would pick it up. "Mitch," Coleman said, pointing to the side of his nose. "You missed a spot." Rapp wiped at his face, and his fingers came back streaked with blood. "Okay," Coleman said. "You're good." They managed to get everything moved in just over 5 minutes. Another 30 seconds passed before they heard an engine approaching from the south. The FedEx delivery truck slowed and pulled into a narrow indentation in the trees just as the second hand on Rapp's watch hit 12. Next time he was in need of this kind of logistical support, Maria Glauser would be on his shortlist. The driver opened the rear doors from inside, revealing boxes stacked floor to ceiling and a hatch open in the false floor. Rapp and Coleman grabbed the body bag first, sliding it inside the space that had been intended for a drugged Leo Obrecht. The driver helped them load the rest of the gear and then closed the well-disguised access door. After another 30 seconds of arranging boxes on top of it, Rapp retreated into the trees and watched the truck accelerate up the road with Coleman in the passenger seat. His blonde hair and flawless German would minimize questions if they were stopped. Rapp started walking south, paralleling the road. The slow pace felt odd, but he was wearing slick dress shoes, and drenching himself in sweat wouldn't do much to enhance his cover. At 15 minutes he drifted closer to the road. Once again, Glauser was right on time. He stepped onto the shoulder, and she slowed just long enough for him to jump into the passenger seat. He immediately leaned back and closed his eyes, trying to let his mind go blank. When he got back to Langley, it was going to be like a bomb going off. What he needed now was a few minutes to clear his head. "Are you all right?" Normally he would have ignored the question, but Glauser's voice was shaking badly enough that even a half-deaf cop would pick up on it. "Relax, Maria. You did great. It's almost over."
"I was told I'd have to move some people and equipment," she said, the words tumbling breathlessly from her mouth. "You don't transport people in body bags. You transport bodies in them. And with those Gatling guns? They sounded like Gatling guns. I blew up a house. A house. Then I had people call the police and lie about it."
Clearly the subject wasn't going to die on its own. "We told you about the house, Maria."
"You said it was our last resort."
"It was. Now take me to the airport."
"The airport? We're supposed to rendezvous with your people at—"
"Plans have changed."
"But Director Kennedy said—"
"Airport, Maria. And don't talk anymore until we get there, okay?" Chapter 33 ISI Headquarters, Islamabad, Pakistan. Kabir Gadai knocked quietly and then entered the ISI director's office. He found Taj sitting at his desk, staring at an empty wall. The younger man stopped immediately, leaving as much space between them as the office would allow. Taj's anger had clearly defined levels, and his deathly stillness was a sign of the last. A rage so intense that it couldn't be processed. Gadai had seen him like this only once before, and it had ended with 7 men from the S-Wing being summarily executed along with their families. Thank Allah he was there to report good news. He had to assume that Taj's anger was the result of the Obrecht operation, which had been carried out during Gadai's time in Rome. The question was whether the prudent course was to inquire about it, or to ignore the subject entirely. "Things went extremely well with Isabella Occorso," Gadai said, keeping his tone submissive. "Just as you planned." Taj's eyes remained fixed, and his body motionless. It was impossible that he hadn't heard. Gadai began to wonder if he had done something to displease the ISI director. He racked his brain but could come up with nothing. It mattered little, though. Only what Taj believed was of importance. The silence stretched out long enough that Gadai could no longer endure it. No one knew for certain what had happened to Taj's previous assistant. The man's broken body was found by people scavenging a trash heap, and his death had been quickly deemed an accident. Of what type? No one had ever attempted to determine. If that was to be his fate, it would be better to find out quickly, to have an opportunity to defend himself before Taj's anger grew further, and, if necessary, to beg for mercy for his sons. "The Obrecht operation, sir? I trust it met with similar success?" Taj's eyes flickered, and Gadai resisted an urge to step back, knowing that the wall behind him would prevent it.
"Obrecht is dead," Taj said finally. "Rapp is not."
Gadai didn't let his relief show. He'd had no hand in planning that operation, and in fact had pointed out its numerous potential pitfalls. The ISI was in the business of knowing everything there was to know about Mitch Rapp. Its files were likely more extensive than those at any other intelligence agency in the world, including the CIA. What those files described was a man who had walked away from certain death on countless occasions, each time leaving in his wake the bodies of men who believed themselves to be assured of victory.
"And Gould?" Gadai prompted gently.
"Also dead."
Gadai nodded. He also had warned against the killing of Abdul Qayyim. While it was true that the Afghan general knew far too much to be allowed to fall into the hands of the CIA, it was also true that his death had left the ISI with no obvious path to Mitch Rapp. Qayyim could have been used to bait a trap deployed on terrain they controlled. Quetta, North Waziristan, or any of a number of sites in Afghanistan. Rapp could have been isolated and pitted against an overwhelming force. Of course, pointing this out would be unwise to the extreme. Better to accentuate the positive.
Gould and Obrecht were loose ends that we would have been forced to deal with sooner than later, Hamid. Rapp has done our work for us, while allowing us to remain in the shadows. And in the end, he is only one man.
That caused Taj to spin toward him.
"I am only one man, Kabir. Sometimes one man is all it takes to change the order of things."
"I hardly think it's a fair comparison," Gadai said. "Mitch Rapp is a simple enforcer, constrained by a dysfunctional and cowardly government. You are a brilliant man who will soon lead one of the most powerful countries in the world."
"Don't patronize me, Kabir. I know what you're thinking. Qayyim."
"Not at all," Gadai lied smoothly. "In light of Rapp's escape from Switzerland, it's clear that you are right. The risks of leaving the general alive were too great."
Taj's eyes narrowed, but thankfully he chose not to pursue the subject.
"I understand you have Rickman's files."
"Yes, sir. And they've been wiped from the law firm system."
"Including the backups?"
"Absolutely."
"The woman?"
"She and her daughter are both dead. The authorities are treating it as an accident. No criminal investigation has been initiated, and none is planned, according to our sources."
He nodded and seemed to relax a bit. Rapp's survival was undoubtedly dangerous, but with the Rickman files in their possession, the assassin could be neutralized. Without the support of the American president and the CIA infrastructure, he would become less than nothing.
"Have you been able to access the information?"
Taj asked, though he almost certainly knew the answer to the question.
"They're encrypted."
You didn't get the key from the law firm?
They didn't have it. But the instructions for the file's dissemination weren't encrypted. In fact, the next release is scheduled for tomorrow. Our people think that this is the path to accessing the information.
Explain.
We believe the man who is decrypting and sending out the files is some kind of computer criminal. The law firm couldn't be allowed to see the contents of the files because they would have called the authorities. Conversely, a criminal couldn't be given access to all the files at one time because he might have sought to use them for his own ends. It's the combination of the two organizations, one legal and one not, that made Rickman's system work.
Then you can find this computer criminal?
We believe so, through his email address.
You believe so?
Taj said, the volume of his voice rising noticeably.
If we can't access the information in his files, we've learned nothing, accomplished nothing. We have the tools to crush America's entire intelligence empire in our hands, and we can't use them. Find this man, Kabir. Find him now.
Yes, sir. But I want you to know that doing so will involve some compromises. Taj's expression turned suspicious.
What kind of compromises?
On the surface, his email address is administered through a server in Singapore, so I think we can be confident that he's not a resident of that country. It's simply a gateway. After the email arrives there, it would be forwarded all over the world in the span of only a few seconds, creating a trail that's very difficult to follow.
But not impossible.
No, sir. Not impossible. We'll get closer with each file release. Eventually, it will lead us to...
Each file release? What are you saying, Kavya?
That we will have to continue sending the files per Rickman's schedule. Taj stared silently at him for a few seconds.
It's a dangerous game. We don't know what is in those files and who the ultimate recipient will be.
I agree, sir, but I think that the risks are acceptable in light of the reward.
How many releases will have to be carried out before we find the man we're looking for?
It's impossible to say for certain, but our hope is no more than 5. In the end, though, at least we know that each release will damage the CIA. So if it's more than 5...
The route to power isn't through clumsy attacks on the CIA, Kabir. It's through subverting the organization, creating double agents, blackmailing informants and politicians, turning an intelligence network they spent hundreds of billions to create against them.
Yes, sir. But chipping away at America's ability to defend itself and the internal chaos that the releases will create is hardly an unattractive secondary strategy. Taj's frown suggested that he was unwilling to accept anything but complete victory.
Then it's your recommendation that we go forward with the scheduled release tomorrow and continue until we identify the man carrying them out?
Yes, sir. The death of President Chutani is less than a week away. Even if there were no hope of getting the encryption key, this would be the most prudent course of action. It will keep the CIA and Mitch Rapp focused elsewhere. Taj just nodded, unwilling to give his authorization aloud. It was clear that he was making Gadai entirely responsible. There would be no reward for success. It was expected. Failure, on the other hand, would be severely punished.
Chapter 34. The Farm. Outside Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, USA. Black clouds blanketed the sky, producing heavy drops that roared against Irene Kennedy's armored SUV. Her driver slowed further on the curving gravel road, leaning over the wheel to better see through the overwhelmed wipers. It seemed fitting somehow. Kennedy stared out the window at the deluge, but didn't really register it. The Swiss authorities and Interpol were currently descending on what had been Leo Obrecht's mansion, cataloging damage, identifying bodies, and collecting evidence. An army of European financial regulators had locked down his bank and were starting the process of unraveling what would likely become the largest and most sophisticated criminal financing operation in history. Her people were quietly leaking fabricated evidence that would lead to the conclusion that Obrecht had gotten in over his head and provoked the wrath of Louis Gould.
There were no guarantees, though. It was a mess of epic proportions, just like Joe Rickman intended. Her driver rolled to a stop alongside the farmhouse, getting as close as he could to the steps. The features of the man looking down from the covered porch were obscured by the rain, and for a brief moment Kennedy felt the breath catch in her chest. She allowed the fantasy to play at the edges of her mind for a moment, but she knew it wasn't Stan Hurley. It never would be again. Her door was pulled open, and she ducked beneath the umbrella held by her driver.
"Where's Mitch?"
she asked Mike Nash as he moved to open the door for her.
"No one knows."
A flash of anger interrupted her grief, but she knew there was no point to it. Rapp would reappear when he wanted to, not a moment before.
"What about—"
her voice lost its strength for a moment.
"What about Stan?"
"We have him," Nash said, leading her inside. "No need to worry.
I want to see him."
"There's nothing to see, Irene. He's dead."
"I know he's dead," she snapped. "Just take me to him."
Nash let out a long breath and led her into the kitchen. There was a walk-in freezer set into the back wall, installed in case they ever needed to feed a large security team. He pointed to it.
"Seriously, Irene, I don't see the—"
"Open it." Nash would never be able to understand what she was feeling. He and Hurley had been close, but she had known the man since she was a little girl. Even after she'd become his boss, he'd always seemed bigger than life to her. Incorruptible, unwavering, and indestructible. Her intellect told her that he was gone, but the child who still lived somewhere inside her couldn't believe that the man she'd known as Uncle Stan was dead. Nash reached for the freezer's handle, but then hesitated.
"There's something I should probably—"
"Just open it, Mike." The intensity of her anger surprised her, but he wasn't its target. She was angry with herself. Hurley had died trying to clean up her mess. And now she could feel herself losing her nerve. She'd approved his involvement in the Obrecht operation, knowing he was old and sick. The least she could do was face him. Nash pulled back the heavy steel door, and she stepped inside, her eyes taking a moment to adjust to the lower light. When they did, she found herself unable to move. She'd prepared herself, but not for this.
"That's what I wanted to warn you about, Irene. We laid him out next to the stakes, but for some reason it really bothered Scott. So this is what we figured out."
Hurley was sitting in a chair, with a drink in one hand and a cigarette frozen between the fingers of the other. Ice had collected on his eyebrows, hanging down over closed eyes. His suit jacket had been pulled closed to the degree practical, but the blood-stained shirt beneath was still visible. Nash draped a blanket over her shoulders, but she didn't acknowledge it. "I'll give you a minute," he said, and she heard his footsteps retreat back into the kitchen. For some reason, she could feel neither the cold nor the weight of the blanket. Other than Hurley, sitting in front of her, all she could sense was the buzz of the overhead light and the hum of the refrigeration unit. Her father had been a CIA operative, and most of her youth was spent in the Middle East. She'd been no older than 6 when she'd first met Stan Hurley. He'd come through Baghdad for what she now knew was an extraction in Libya. When her father had been killed in Beirut, his old friend Hurley had done his best to step in. He'd called when he could, made sure she had enough money, and convinced her to pursue her PhD. It had been him who had convinced her to apply to the agency. And he had watched over her career until she became director. Kennedy approached and put a hand on his arm. "Goodbye, Stan." When she finally walked out of the freezer, Nash was sitting at the kitchen table. He stood, a sincere expression of concern on his face. Despite being a former recon Marine with more combat commendations than she could be bothered to count, there was a certain gentleness about him. It was most visible when he was around his family, but it came out at times like this, too. She and Rapp saw it as weakness, despite his impeccable ops record, but now she wondered if she'd rushed to judgment. He was a difficult man to dislike, and that could be a very powerful weapon in their business. Sometimes more powerful than the gun.
Are you all right, Irene? She wasn't sure. Handling stress was part of the job, but even she had limits. Rickman's files were still out there. Leo Obrecht was scheduled to be buried later that week, and she was responsible for the death of her oldest friend. Nash seemed to read her mind. It would have destroyed him if you hadn't sent him, Irene. If you lost confidence in him. Take it from me. This is better. She nodded numbly. What happened, Mike?
Gould. Obrecht's people were expecting them.
How? We had Gould. There was no way for him to communicate.
Nash slid a newspaper across the table and tapped a want ad circled in highlighter. This newspaper was the only information he got from the outside while we were holding him. Our guys went over it with a fine-tooth comb and found this. It basically outlines the plan. There are similar messages in periodicals and websites worldwide.
How did Obrecht die? Was it Mitch?
Nash shook his head. Looks like one of his guards. It was what she was afraid of.